Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Another episode of Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge, and I'm so excited to be here today. I'm usually excited in general, but it is the 40th anniversary of one of my all-time favorite movies ever, and that movie is Superman, directed by Richard Donner, released in 1978, and they're doing all these big screenings all across the country, and I am going to go see it today, and I needed to find someone who had never seen Superman, and I found someone, and this man has never been on the show before. This is his first podcast appearance in the history of the internet. I'm very excited to have TC Padgett with me here today. TC, welcome to the show.
Sean, thank you so much for having me.
I am thrilled that you're here, and I'm thrilled I get to watch this movie, not only that we're watching it, but we are going to a movie theater to see it, just the way everyone intended. We've talked a little bit because you're a big Spider-Man fan, right?
I am.
Spider-Man's your favorite.
He is. I'm a lifelong comic book fan in general, though. But yes, Spider-Man
right.
is my favorite.
Okay. So Superman, are you a fan of Superman, or is it something you're just kind of like,
I wouldn't call myself a fan. I'm intrigued by Superman.
Okay.
In general, I wouldn't call myself much of a DC fan. I've dabbled in DC throughout my life, but I've never read sustained runs of DC comics. I've never followed DC movies. But
It's probably best for the later DC movies.
For the later ones, yeah. I mean, I certainly grew up as a kid watching the Tim Burton Batman movies.
Okay.
Those were my jam. I was thinking back, though, and I don't, even now, with the glut, I guess, of Superman movies that there are, I've never seen a single Superman movie, I don't think.
That's amazing. So Superman's my favorite. It's weird. I always go back to, like, whenever someone asks me who my favorite superhero is, I think Superman is always my favorite, but I mean, I love Spider-Man, I love Batman, I love Daredevil. I kind of go back to all those, but Superman always ends up being kind of the number one for me. And I think a lot of it is because that was the first superhero I was exposed to. One of my earliest memories is being like 3 or 4 years old and having a Superman costume and running around my house, and my parents would sing the song, which would embarrass me, and I'd be like, stop it, leave me alone. But I didn't know anything about I was like, so what does Superman do? And they'd be like, oh, he can fly and he's like really powerful and invincible.
He leaps something some kind of bound.
He's faster than a something. So all this stuff. And I remember one of the first times I think I saw anything related to the movies was there was a commercial on television for the like TV screening of the first movie. And there's a point in this movie, and I hope this isn't spoiling anything since you haven't seen it, there's a point where Superman falls into a swimming pool in this movie. And I remember asking my dad, I was like, Dad, why did he fall into a swimming pool? I can tell you that, again, spoiling a little bit, but kryptonite's involved. But my dad, for some reason, was like, oh, he has a stomach ache. I was like, Dad, wait.
He's too young to know about kryptonite. Don't tell the boy.
Kryptonite, I mean, he's 3 years old. You have to wait a little bit.
And then later we'll tell him about red kryptonite.
Red kryptonite, which is the worst by far. But I remember even as like a three-year-old thinking like, that doesn't make sense because if he's so powerful, how would a stomach ache? And it sent me on this like completely like the spiral of like, but if Superman could get a stomach ache, like, is there anything that I can believe in anymore? And it was just it was a crisis of conscience like I've never experienced before in my life. But the first time I ever really saw Superman, I was probably, I think it was like a year or two later. I was maybe 5 years old, and I would sneak out of my room. I developed an internal clock from a very young age. And it was specifically because when I was supposed to be in bed at nap time, like around noon, I would like know what time it was, sneak downstairs to the basement and watch like Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers. Mm-hmm. And I would just put those on. And I always knew instinctively what time it was. And I was supposed to be in bed and I would never sleep. I would just sneak out and watch television. And one time I think at some point, I don't know what inspired it, but I was like, I have to see Superman. I need to see something. I'm sure somewhere in this house there's something Superman related. And my parents would tape movies off of the television. And I think at this point I had like a TV version of Back to the Future that I would watch religiously. And I was like, there's got to be Superman here somewhere. So I could read the word super, but for some reason I couldn't understand the word man. So I'd recognize super, but anything following that, I was like, I don't know what this is, but I assume it's Superman. But I would like put on VHS tape after VHS tape, and it was all like Super Bowl programs from my parents had taped from years past. And then eventually I did find Superman, and I freaked out so much. I didn't care. There was a part of me maybe in the back of my head. I was like, I probably shouldn't wake up my parents and let them know that I'm destroying nap time and all that it stands for. But I did it anyway. And I rushed into their room and was like, guess what I saw? And then there was the thing, and then he flew and it was great. And they were like, please go away. We were sleeping.
Your dad's just like, did he find out about the kryptonite?
Does he know the stomach ache is not true? But yeah, so I think what it is about Superman that I love is that he is so powerful and so invincible, but he can, you know, kick the crap out of anybody, but he's not so good that he can't like save a cat from a tree or like something along the, he's like a very like kind of all shucks, polite, thoughtful, very generous.
He probably does get stomach aches.
He gets he seems like the type of guy who could get nervous
his
about
biology
something.
Seems similar enough to ours.
Right, exactly. So I think when it came down to it, there was that. There was also the fact that with Superman, I think Spider-Man maybe has one of the great origin stories, if not the greatest origin story. I think the whole idea of not only was his parent figure killed, but he played a part in that happening. Like, he feels responsible for that. I think that's brilliant. And, you know, Batman, it feels like every superhero, it's like, oh, their parents got killed or there's something tragic. And with Superman, it's nothing like so tragic as like, oh, I must avenge my parents. He's just like, I just want to do the right thing. And as a kid, I don't know, growing up and getting older, I was always kind of, I was just attracted to that. Like, I liked the idea of a superhero who could do literally anything, but is like, no, I'm just going to be a good person and help people. And I liked that a lot.
And I think that's really getting back to the idea of being intrigued by Superman. That's really what does intrigue me, is that he has absolute power, and they say that corrupts, but he seems to always do what's right.
Yeah.
Or at least sticks to his own moral code of what he believes is right.
Exactly. And I love Batman. I love Spider-Man. Like, these are really, it's kind of interchangeable as to who my favorite is, but the reason I think I always fall back on Superman is just that kind of comfort of it. Like, oh, Superman's out there somewhere, and as long as he's out there, we'll be okay, or we'll be safe, and that kind of stuff. But what's really cool, and why I'm excited to show you this movie, and I'm excited we get to go see it in theaters, is Superman was released in 1978, and this was right after, it was in production at the same time as Star Wars, which, you know, Star Wars changed everything, and Superman was released the year after. And at the time, superheroes and comic books, and I'm not as well versed in it, but I'm sure you can agree with me, in the 70s in particular, they weren't necessarily seen as high art or even something that was well respected. No,
there are actually interviews I've read from Marvel writers who writing in the 70s who have said they didn't think it was going to continue.
Yeah.
They thought they were living out the end of that boom.
And you can see it in the comics from that period of time, especially just looking at DC. Marvel had the advantage of very human characters with very relatable problems and at least interesting storylines. But DC was very, like, big sensational stuff. Like, there was red kryptonite, blue kryptonite, black kryptonite. There was the super pony, the super dog. Like, everything was, like, a big, like, what new big, like, character or plot point can we introduce? I know there was one comic where Lois Lane, it's integral for her to live out 24 hours as a black woman for some reason.
I'm vaguely aware of that.
Have you read that one?
No, I haven't.
We got to find a copy of that. That's actually a Superman movie, I think, ripe for the making. I think someday they should dive into that.
There's a similar storyline with the Punisher, so maybe we can get a different
Punisher. We can get a crossover. That would be fantastic. But this is all to say, in the 70s, superhero movies and superheroes in general weren't really well respected. And these two producers, it was, I think it's Ilya and Alexander Salkind. They're big kind of moguls, like the people, like kind of stereotypical, like cigar chomping, like, we're going to make a movie, of course. But think of it with, I don't know, I think they're Russian. So I cannot do a Russian accent. That is my best attempt. But think of it, and without the deepness and the them sounding like crazy James Bond villains, they were like, they had the rights to Superman and they wanted to make a Superman movie. They just made Three Musketeers, which was a huge success for them. And I think they were looking for, like, oh, what's the next big box office smash we can do? And they somehow got the rights for Superman, and they called Richard Donner. They'd gone through a couple, I think, attempts at a director. I can't remember. There were some interesting names in there, but they, for whatever reason, it fell through. And then they got in contact with Richard Donner, who had just made The Omen. Have you seen The Omen?
No, not the original. I've seen the remake that came out in 2006.
You poor... poor man.
From what I understand, it was very similar.
Yeah, I hear they're absolutely identical, except one is great and one is terrible, which I'll let you decide which is which. But so Donner had just made The Omen, and it was a huge hit, and it's a wonderful movie. If you haven't seen it, audience, go see The Omen. It's one of the great horror movies. But they contacted him, and they were like, we want you to make Superman. And Richard Donner was kind of like, all right, let's do this. And he got the script, which, funny story, had been originally written by Mario Puzo, who wrote The Godfather. So he's one of like 50 screenwriters credited with the screenplay, but he came up with this epic tale. He's like, oh, it's a Greek tragedy and da da da. So this grandeur and all this epic stuff is in this 500 page script that Richard Donner gets. And the intention was, we're going to make Superman 1 and 2 back to back. And this is, I think, back before that was even a big thing that they would do. So they were like, it'll be cheaper if we make them back to back, and we'll make twice as much money. So Richard Donner gets the script. He and his story collaborator, Tom Mankiewicz, who was integral to a lot of the Roger Moore Bond movies. So a lot of the worst Bond movies you've seen, but that's not completely true. He did a lot of, he wrote wonderful stories, and he brought a lot of the charm to that franchise that Roger Moore is well known for. But they kind of sat down, looked at the script, and the script had gotten, it was written by Mario Puzo, and then I think David and Leslie Newman, a husband-wife duo, screenwriting duo, had written a draft, and it was ridiculous. Like, it was like very, lots of parody, lots of camp. At this point in time, the most famous live-action interpretation of a superhero was Batman, the Adam West Batman. Which have you had?
I am very familiar with the Adam West Batman.
Because, as you should be, as everyone should be. Because to be completely honest, I know in this day and age it's not cool, but we did a whole episode of Missing Frames about this, where we talk about how that interpretation of Batman, even though it's not dark and brooding, is still hysterical and wonderful in its own right. But at the time, that was the most mainstream version of a superhero. So I think people were kind of like, how do you even make this like genuine and not have it be ridiculous? You can't do it. So Donner and Mankiewicz look at the script, and it's got absurd stuff in it. There was one, I think Terry Savalas, who's Kojak. Does that sound
Telly Savalas.
Yeah. There's a scene where Superman thinks he sees a bald head walking around. He's like, it's Lex Luthor. And it's actually Telly Savalas. And he goes, hey, who loves you, baby? And it was moments like that throughout the script. He, for some reason, said, we're not doing that. We're going to treat this with respect, and we're going to make something that, like, we'll take seriously. And what's amazing about that is, to me, you have Jaws in 1975. That's one, like, the first quote-unquote blockbuster. Star Wars kicks it up to another level. And then you have Superman, and I feel like Superman is the third part of that conversation, the big blockbuster in the 70s that spawned... Essentially, you look at the landscape today, and nothing we have would exist without Superman, this first movie that came out in the 70s. And there's so much about it, I think, that is like, I think the most impressive thing is there are elements of camp to it, and it feels goofy at times, but it's all very sincere, and it's all done very with this aura of grandeur that you don't really see, because superhero films come out so frequently now, you don't really see it as much anymore. Mm-hmm. But I love the Marvel movies, but there's something about getting one every few months, and they're all connected, so it feels like you have to see all of them to kind of get the story and understand what's happening. And this is back in an era when a superhero movie kind of existed on its own terms, so you get the sense of like, it's an event movie, mm-hmm. it's epic, it's exciting, and it's wonderful, but it's also got this kind of sincerity and heart to it that I isn't necessarily missing from superhero movies these days, but it feels purer and less manufactured.
Yeah, I've heard from a couple sources. I don't know where I read or heard this, and not knowing anything really about the movie itself, I've heard it's not as much of a superhero movie, and it is more of a human tale, I suppose.
Yeah, it has like the set pieces, but it's not like it feels more like a James Bond movie, honestly, which isn't surprising considering Lex Luthor. This is before they'd introduced the business mogul angle, so this is pre-John Byrne.
Yes.
And so he's like maniacal scientist. He's basically a Bond villain. He has a big lair.
And from what I've seen, I'll just get this out of the way, he has hair in this movie.
He has
Sean.
Hair in this movie.
I don't know what to think.
I don't know what to believe. Exactly. So it's a completely different take. And I think it's I think there's a lot to this movie that feels very would play such a huge part in shaping what the character was, but in some ways, just speaking to the comic book landscape at the time, Superman not only was, I think, a great movie, and it did extremely well at the box office. It was the most expensive movie at the time, $55 million, which I think is about $200 million in today's dollars, but it was a huge hit, critically acclaimed, really well received. But I think that one of its biggest contributions was to legitimizing superheroes. This is the first real example. You know, you had Kirk Allen and George Reeves back in the 40s and 50s, and mm-hmm. those are beloved, but this is black and white television. It's hokey. It doesn't feel real. This is the first time they were like, we're going to make this big, epic superhero movie. We're going to put the money behind it and make it feel grand. So I love watching it from that regard, and I think it's ridiculously entertaining. Did you ever have any interest in seeing this growing up, or was it just kind of like,
I didn't really, it didn't look very exciting to me every time I saw. And I do have a memory of my dad watching Superman 3. I remember seeing Richard Pryor in it, and I had no idea what I was watching when I saw it. It did not look like a superhero movie.
I can tell you this much. I watch Superman 3 to this day, and I don't know what I'm watching. I think that is not limited to being young. I think that is the atmosphere that film creates.
And I think I was born in the late 80s. I think by that I was just gonna be a Batman fan.
Yeah.
I think it's just those movies were just coming out.
Right.
It was a big deal. Batman Returns was one of the first movies I saw in the theaters as a kid.
Oh, wow.
So it has a special place in my heart. And so looking at that, there were no real Superman movies coming out, and it was something I would still see Superman on TV. I watched a lot of Nick at Night, so I would see the George Reeves Superman. I watched a lot of Super Friends on Cartoon Network, so I kind of had that weird saccharine perspective of Superman, which I think a lot of people have.
Yes,
it's
true.
Very Boy Scout kind of attitude.
And that's without going too into detail, we'll talk more about it after when we see the movie, but I think the problems that people associate with Superman nowadays are also spawned by this movie. This is still to this day the best live action interpretation of the hero, the most popular for sure. And I think a lot of it, to bring it back to the Bond comparisons, it's very similar in terms of James Bond always gets the girl, always has the right gadget, always, doesn't really have much of a struggle. It's very similar to this movie. This is kind of a big spectacle with a lot more heart, I think, than Bond. Like, Bond is very, like, suave and cool, but not, like, heartfelt. Mm-hmm. Superman's very heartfelt, but it's still a lot of the similar pitfalls, I think, that James Bond has, being, like, a super spy who is always going to win the day. Superman's the infallible Boy Scout who always does the right thing and is impervious to everything. So I think a lot of the issues that people have with Superman do stem from this interpretation, because frankly, for some reason, people struggle with, like, either he's perfect and wonderful and kind of square, or he's angry and brooding and just a jerk. And, like, they can't find the right balance between the two. But I think the reason this one works so well is just because the character is so endearing and lovable that you're like, I like that guy. I want to invite him home to my parents and introduce him and maybe get married at some point as well. Mm. That's how I feel about Superman. I'd like to marry him.
I had a feeling it was going to come to that.
This is basically therapy for me. But I think the big things one of the key things to look out for. I think this movie has the longest opening credits I've ever seen, because they've got to let that John Williams score play out, and it's magnificent. Some other fun stuff, I'll touch on it a little bit, but this is originally filmed back-to-back with Superman 2, and this was going to end with a cliffhanger ending, but tensions between Donner and the producers became so heated on set because they were like, oh, you're going over budget and you're going over schedule. And he was like, you guys never gave me a schedule or a budget, otherwise I would absolutely follow it. And things became so heated that eventually they fired Donner and were like, we're just going to tack the ending of Superman 2 onto this movie. And you can kind of feel it when you get to the third act of the movie. You're like, this feels rushed and kind of slapdash, but I think overall the charm of it holds up. But the last thing I want to ask you is, where is your excitement level as far as watching?
I'm more excited than not. I think, honestly, the James Bond comparison makes me more excited. I have very fond memories of Bond movies as a child.
So, yes.
And especially Roger Moore ones.
And so Roger Moore is wonderful. This is, yeah. I think...
all those campy Bond movies were perfect for me as a child.
Right. This movie is very much an origin story, so you'll see a lot of similarities. I think Sam Raimi, Nolan have specifically referenced this movie as basically setting the foundation for what they wanted to achieve with their first Spider-Man, their first Batman movie. Mm-hmm. So you'll see a lot of similarities in terms of the way the origin story plays out, the way Superman doesn't really make an appearance until, like, I think, I want to say an hour into the movie. So you're kind of like, you feel the way this origin story has kind of shaped the way origin stories would be told from that point on. And it's a great mm-hmm. template. I haven't seen this in a while, and I'm thrilled to watch it again. So we're going to watch it. We're going to watch it in the movie theater, and it's going to be great. And we'll come back and talk about it.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. TC, I have one question for you. Do you believe a man can fly?
I do. Yes. I have no doubts. Yes. After seeing now, the amazing special effects of Superman the movie.
There you go. And I was almost, because Superman is tough. Star Wars gets away with a lot because you're talking about model spaceships with black backdrops. Like, you can hide a lot of the matte lines. You can hide a lot of the scenes with the special effects. So it holds up a lot better. Superman has to contend with the fact that you're making a normal person do really fantastical things. So it's a little harder to buy into it, and some of the stuff doesn't hold up as well. But I was actually kind of shocked watching it on a big screen, and I think this is the new 4K scan they did and just released, but it looks so wonderful, and I miss in-camera effects. I say that a lot, and I am not a stickler. I love CG, and I think it's great, but there's something about watching Superman and seeing him fly and seeing Christopher Reeve, who's amazing, and he was a pilot, so you get the vibe, like, the way he flies and the way he maneuvers himself is very, it makes the whole thing so believable. But you enjoyed it.
I did. Overall, I was really impressed. And I think there was a lot to like about this movie.
Nice. What were the things that you were not expecting as far as starting from the get-go, like kicking things off? I do like that the first line in this movie is, this is no fantasy, which is kind of like, that's our kind of our mantra for this movie, is that we're going to do this mm-hmm. as seriously and as believably as possible, even right. though we're dealing with fantastical stuff. But give me a play-by-play. Walk me through your experience with the movie. Marlon Brando's beautiful face shows up on screen. How did you feel?
He plays Jor-El from Krypton.
From Krypton.
down the street, Krypton.
Yes.
I was really impressed with everything from Krypton, I want to say. I knew Marlon Brando was going to be good. I was worried in a lot of ways about getting bogged down in another origin story. I know a lot of superhero movies can suffer from that, but at the end of it, I still wanted more Krypton. Yeah. I was really grabbed by the set pieces there and the whole atmosphere there. You mentioned Greek tragedy being kind of an influence on the screenplay, maybe early on or something with Mario Puzo. And I felt like that came across the most in the early parts with the Krypton scenes.
Yeah, it's very, very kind of elegant, and mm-hmm. they're all speaking in this sort of Shakespearean dialect. Like, their dialogue is very, very dramatic mm-hmm. and very stylized in mm-hmm. that way. And I think a lot of the Puzo stuff was kept for Krypton. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it feels that way. And this movie, it's interesting. I've seen this movie so many times. It's hard to, if there's a movie you love and you've seen it a lot, you have a tough time like separating yourself from it and trying to examine it from like, okay, let me just sit back and try to like really think about it. This movie is so ingrained in my like life, and I've seen it so many times that it's all so familiar to me. And I sometimes forget, and sometimes the things that stood out to me maybe on a first viewing don't stand up or stand up as much, or I take it for granted. But something I noticed is, I think comparing it a lot to superhero movies these days, where it's like, we got to get going, it's got to be action, it's got to be fast, and da-da-da. And Superman has, the opening credits is basically the opening action sequence, which is 5.5 minutes of that amazing soundtrack.
The whooshing, the words,
which apparently was this incredible special effect that cost like, I don't know what the cost was. I don't think it was millions of dollars, but I know it was some astronomical cost. Like even the opening credits cost $1 million, but it's like it totally sets the mood for the movie. But then the movie's relatively like, it doesn't really rush itself. There's the set piece of Krypton exploding and everything going wrong, but it's not like there isn't any big action sequence.
And you mentioned that Superman didn't show up right away in this movie. And
yeah.
And that's true, but I don't think the movie ever wanted for Superman himself to show up.
Yeah.
He had enough going on that I never found myself asking, when is he going to put on the costume?
Right.
I never really came across
You're
my
so
mind.
Involved in the story. And the, I mean, it does, I think Donner's direction is very, it gives Superman, the movie, a sense of grandeur and a sense of epicness that isn't, I don't think you find in a lot of superhero movies. This movie feels, like I was saying before, it feels like a big event movie. It feels like it fits on the shelf that has Star Wars and Jaws and these big movies that came, even like 2001, which is a wonderful movie. This was also photographed. It was shot by Jeffrey Unsworth, who was the director of photography on 2001, which is really cool. And this, I think, was his last movie. The movie is dedicated to Jeffrey Unsworth, but it's beautiful, and it looks so wonderful. But in these opening scenes, they do a really great job of kind of setting you up as like, oh, this is something where it's not going to be hokey. It's not going to feel fake. We're not going to see like ridiculous cardboard spaceships or things like that. The model work definitely is like, oh yeah, this is clearly a model. This is not, believe it or not, they did not go to Krypton to shoot this movie.
Maybe one day.
I was kind of shocked it holds up so well. And I love, like you said, the style.
One thing that I kept coming back to as well of the movie as a whole is how self-aware it really seems.
Yeah.
It's... Like, Clark Kent is an anachronism, but his character seems to know he's an anachronism.
Yeah.
That he knows he's out of place because I guess they've been telling him his whole life, and he should know by now, you will be an oddball.
Yeah.
But he's aware of it, and a lot of the tropes that make Superman from his creation were riffed on in this movie in a very, what I presume was a 1978 kind of way, where he's talking about truth, justice, and the American way, and Lois Lane is scoffing, saying every politician is going to be on your list.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff where they nod to that. Like, I remember Donner doing an interview where he was talking about, you know, this wasn't like this was 78, so this is like the peak of cynicism in America. Mm-hmm. We weren't like some movie that's coming out and people were like, yeah, that's what the times were like. People stood for the American way. What he was saying is just as corny then as it is now. And it was purposefully done. Like, but the sincerity of the performance, you like fully believe it, and you don't get the like vibe of like, oh, what's this smarmy guy? Truth. When he says I'm here to fight for truth, justice, and the American way. It's like, yeah, the American way. That's not something I believe in anymore. But somehow when he says it, I it seems completely reasonable. But I do love the way this movie, kind of what it does that's so brilliant is it sets you up to believe in the world. So you're on Krypton and it's fantastical and it's a little stiff and a little clinical, and then you get to Earth and it's very, Donner was going for like kind of the John Ford westerns and like these big vistas of like, oh, there's the fields of grain, the bright blue skies. It feels very like this kind of almost dreamy sort of landscape, like, ah, yes, the 1950s America that we miss back in the good old days. But we get to spend some time with Clark in high school and see what his upbringing was like. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely adore the scenes with him and Pa Kent, because you don't get a lot. The movie has a lot of heart and it has a lot of emotion, but that's really kind of, I think, the most emotional it gets in terms of providing you with a, here's why Superman does what he does. Here's what he's fighting for. Here are his family values. You don't really spend a lot of time with Jonathan or Martha.
I expected a little more Smallville stuff, to be honest. But
did it work for you?
It did. I appreciated just the small digest version of what his life in Smallville was like. Just a little snapshot and then move on to Metropolis.
Yes, exactly. So you have the first act is very, you know, outer space. Second act, kind of the classic America, this beautiful landscape or whatever, and these images that are kind of evocative of that time. And then you get to the third act, which is very fast paced, very fun and zany. But by that point, it's like we've been settled into the world. We're more willing to believe the ridiculousness of it because we've already, it's almost like those first two acts kind of establish a baseline of sincerity where it's like, we know the movie is going to be kind of winking, but not in a way that's condescending.
We know this is still a man in blue spandex with his underwear on the outside, but just go with us.
Exactly. I wanted to ask you as far as there's the whole, like, he goes to the Fortress of Solitude.
Yes.
Did you think
add water Fortress of Solitude, I noticed.
Did you think that was kryptonite when you first saw it?
I had questions about whether it would become kryptonite.
Right.
I thought maybe some effect would happen, but yeah, it did cross my mind.
That is weird because again, this is a movie so ingrained in me that I don't ask these questions, but thinking about it, I was kind of thinking like, I wonder what TC is thinking about this, like trying to see it through your eyes, watching it for the first time.
Somehow just living in the world and absorbing pop culture, I knew that Jor-El was going to talk to him holographically. And I suppose the beginning of the movie sets that up as well. So I wasn't surprised. And I had a feeling that these crystals were going to be viewing crystals,
right,
so to speak.
Exactly. But it is interesting still that they wanted it to stand out and have a more striking color scheme, but the fact that it's
very
colored
Emerald
the same
City.
As yeah, it's the fact that it's colored the same as kryptonite is a little confusing. But then you have, so he goes to the Fortress of Solitude, he's learning the ways of the forest from Jor-El, and there's an extended like weird dream sequence. How did that play with you?
It was a little strange. I liked it. Thought the it grabbed me. I thought the movie, the beginning of the movie, had more of that already, so it wasn't out of nowhere. And the cosmic elements of Superman interest me, so I was into it.
Yeah, I like the whole movie has this kind of dreamlike quality, which I know I've said before, but that I don't know what it is. It is strange in a big superhero movie to have this kind of trippy sort of like, yes, we're going to spend 10 years in the Fortress of Solitude.
It was like an
going
origin
through the cosmos and
an origin story montage.
Yeah,
that's what it felt like to me. Although we'd already seen the origin in more long form, this was kind of a catching up to speed as to how Clark became Superman.
Right. And then we get to Metropolis. We're at the Daily Planet and we get to see Mr. Christopher Reeve, who is so damn good in this movie. I can't handle it. I just can't every time I watch him, I'm like, he'd gone to Juilliard for acting. And
Juilliard?
Is it Krypton? Juilliard? Juilliard? Whatever it is. But he was a trained actor. But this was his first big break, which is crazy because apparently when he originally screen tested, Donner and the producers were kind of like, he's too skinny. I don't know. He's a little young. But you watch him and it's so like, it's so Superman. I don't know. The amount of confidence he has as Superman and then kind of the bumbling charm he has as Clark. I'm never not like impressed with that performance. But what was it like? When we're first introduced to him, did you see the first introduction when he first shows up to the Daily Planet?
Yes.
Okay. So yes. How did you feel about like kind of the switch in tone from kind of more methodical and thoughtful to kind of zany and a little more slapsticky moving into Metropolis and the first introduction of Clark and Lois?
I enjoyed it. I think it fits with moving from a place like Smallville to a place like Metropolis. It's going to be a small town kid moving to a big city. I can see how things would be swirling all around his head. He seemed to, and probably because of Jor-El's teachings, he seemed to really have a good handle on how the city worked.
Yeah.
So I thought he had a good, he seemed a good anchor. Just thinking about his performance, though, that's possibly the best Clark Kent I think I've seen.
Yeah.
It was so good. When you mentioned that he really differentiated between the two characters, I could really see it.
And
he seemed like a different person.
Yeah, there's the one, the shot I mentioned earlier, too. I don't know if I mentioned it on the show or if we were talking about it afterwards, but the moment where he shows up at Lois's apartment and she's like, oh, let me go get my coat. And he kind of takes off his glasses and does the transformation and you're like, oh man, this is so good. But it's amazing how such a subtle thing can change and be so dramatically different. But I remember, you know, as a kid growing up, Superman 2 was my favorite, but strictly because of the action element. Like, Superman 2 is more action oriented. The three villains at the beginning of this movie come back and Superman has to fight them. So,
and why are they at the beginning of this movie?
Because I think originally the intention was...
well, you mentioned, so one and two shot together, but they're not in one. They're not in the final cut. So why are they in the movie?
So they have the moment at the beginning, which I guess is supposed to establish that Jor-El is like some powerful... If I'm trying to think of it separated from the fact that, yes, I know they're coming back in Superman 2, I'm trying to think how it would work. Let me see if I can justify it to myself. So Jor-El, we established Jor-El. He's some sort of like leader in Krypton, and we have a very serious, like, weird scene. But yeah, frankly, I don't think that moment works unless you know they're coming back. I would like to talk to someone who doesn't know they're in Superman 2.
If I hadn't known better, I would have thought the projectionist put on the wrong reel or something. It's just like,
yeah, unless you see the S, and then it has some cool visuals.
No, I was just like, I thought we were, I might have thought we were watching Superman 2 because it seems like the perfect way to introduce Superman 2.
And Superman 2 does open with a recap of the
villains. So you get to see it again anyway.
Exactly. So, but wow. Marlon Brando's not in it because he wanted money and they were like, no, we're good. A lot of that stuff is, I love the hula hoops, the little hula hoop cage that they're in, and the Fortress of Solitude being like a giant flying diamond.
And then their prison is a flying disc.
Yes.
So I guess Krypton just into geometric based prisons and attacks.
So. Seems to work well for them. Oh, wait, it didn't work. But I used to love Superman 2 more as a kid. From the action perspective, it's like, oh yeah, there's fighting and stuff and it's like things like that. And I remember Superman, I think maybe I was 10 or 11, but Superman came on TV and I was like, yeah, let's watch the first Superman. I haven't watched it in a long time and I was most familiar with Superman 2. But what struck me about the first Superman, and it was the first time where I was like, I think I like this more than the second one, is just the wit of it, like the comedy and the sincerity of it. Like, it's not action oriented, but it's almost smarter than the second movie, which I'm not trying to put the second movie down, but the first one feels a little bit more level headed and thought through.
A lot of the humor was subtle.
Yeah.
I appreciated that. There's a lot of subtlety.
Yeah. It's not like there's slapstick stuff with Lex Luthor and Otis and Miss Tessmacher.
Yes.
But for the most part, it's not, The humor in it is very character driven, and they have great gags. Like, one of my favorites is the phone booth moment where he goes up to the phone booth and it's not the classic phone booth that we've come to associate with Superman, and he just very quickly moves on.
It's one of the first times where I thought, this movie knows what it is.
Exactly. It knows exactly what it's doing. And I think that's partly why it still holds up to this day, is it's not, and again, it's not condescending. I think that's the really wonderful thing about it, is it's very straight faced in the way it presents it. And it's poking fun, but it's more like, yeah, we're all in this together, as opposed to like this stupid comic book.
They didn't go full Adam West.
But exactly.
Particularly the Luthor elements have that kind of vibe to them. You just don't have the Biff Bam Pals and everything. And he only has one sidekick, as opposed to a legion of them that are themed after him.
Exactly. That's very true. And
Two. Sorry, I should count Miss Tessmacher.
Miss Tessmacher. She's too good to be hanging out with them, but she's got a penthouse. I can't remember what he says. Penthouse address, 1,000 feet below ground, whatever. But how did you feel about Margot Kidder as Lois Lane?
Possibly my favorite actor in the movie. I think Christopher Reeve is an amazing Superman, but I thought Margot Kidder carried I'm speaking too strongly when I say carry, but I thought she made a big impression on me in almost every scene she was in.
She's wonderful. And their chemistry is great too. Yes. It's so like, it's wonderful to watch this movie. Now, this is the first time I've seen it since she passed away. Mm-hmm. And I think that was just this year, wasn't it? Yeah, May 13th this year. So watching the scenes of them together, God, it's so wonderful. And even the "Can you read my mind" moment, which is
Sean.
so hysterically like,
why does Lois Lane think in rhyme?
Well, originally that was a song and she was going to sing it. Can you read my mind? And Donner saw it, was like, I think it's just going to be like a spoken verse.
Otherwise, we're getting into like Carrie Fisher, Star Wars Holiday Special territory.
Right. I do think it's funny that maybe it's because he wanted the whole sequence and he thought it was sweet to see them together and having their little flirtation. But part of me is like, maybe you could just cut that.
Definitely the first miss, big miss for me in this movie was that scene.
And it's the only part I think that doesn't, like, today, I feel like that's the only part of the movie I'm like, I'm sorry, I know this is goofy. It's the only part of the movie I feel like I have to apologize for. But honestly, there's a sweetness to it now because they've both passed that almost, I find it so endearing. And again, it's because it happens in an absurd multi-million-dollar movie. This is a huge, epic, like, superhero film that takes the time to, like, let's have a romantic flying sequence with our two leads. Mm. And I kind of love it, even with the goofiness of that. Can you read my mind?
The sequence itself is fine. It was specific. Yeah, specifically the poem just
is ridiculous.
Very cringe.
Yes.
And I'm like, can we not just, if I was watching it on my own, I'd probably just mute it and play Aladdin in the background.
That's the moment where I think it's like, when you, okay, I'm going to go to the bathroom, I'll be back. But and then finally we have Gene Hackman, who is, again, I almost wish we could have seen Gene Hackman in like the business mogul realm, but it would take away from the fact that he's basically the Bond villain of this movie.
When you mentioned James Bond earlier, I have to think you were thinking about Lex Luthor and Friends.
Yes. From a story perspective, it's very, very much supervillain, big like plan to destroy the world, or not destroy the world, but you know, there's a big plan. Yeah,
very grandiose, possibly not scientifically sound plan.
Evil lair, monologues a lot, and all that kind of stuff.
But he should pick his henchmen better.
He should. He has very silly henchmen. But how do you feel? So Otis wasn't your favorite character?
Oh no, I loved Otis. I'm just talking about from a in-universe perspective. Right. I don't know why the smartest man always has to hang out with the stupidest man.
Yeah.
Except that that's been a trope, I'll say, in cinema for a long time, in any kind of entertainment.
I've never understood if it's supposed to be like the bad guy has to have someone to talk to, and all right, we should also make him dumb because it's funny. My guess is that's what it's like. Okay, he needs someone to, like, what's the word? Pontificate? Is that it? Did I pronounce it correctly? I feel
pontificate.
Pontificate, Krypton, and
Terry Savalas.
Terry Savalas, all my favorite things to pronounce. But I think that's probably like, okay, we can't just have him talking to like someone as serious as he is. We have to have like a contrast.
It's very much straight man,
very
comedy
contrast.
Man.
Yeah, but it's those are the scenes that I think are the closest to campy the movie.
Definitely Adam West Batman feel.
Right, but it still works. I think part of it is because Gene Hackman is so good and he's so just like fed up with everything that it just makes all of it more and more hysterical.
I'd be interested to know if he improvised any of his lines. There were some real funny, subtle lines in there.
Well, I love the when I was 12 years old, my father said, "Get out." Before that, just like very quick, like very snappy quick punchlines and things like that. But I love the Otis, would you love to see a very long arm? Oh no, Mr. Luthor. It's all wonderful. I would love to know that as well, because so much of it feels like they're having a lot of fun making the movie. Yes. You can always tell when I'm watching, like, I don't want this to become, you know what, I'm just gonna name names. Let's talk about Man of Steel, because I don't want to this to turn into like a I hate Man of Steel bash fest. I don't hate Man of Steel. I don't think it's great, but I think you can tell when people are having fun making a movie versus not having fun. And when I watch Man of Steel, I'm not having fun. They don't seem like they're having fun. And you watch something like those moments, as silly as they are, but the moments between Hackman and Ned Beatty, and I can't remember Miss Tessmacher's name. I want to look her up.
Apparently
no
one else could either, because they just called her Miss Tessmacher for the entire movie.
Yeah, so I really love, hold on, where, I can't even find it. It's not even listed, and I can't spell her name apparently. All right. Someday I'll find it. But I, those scenes of them together, it, are just so wonderful. Mm. And it's funny because Brando and Hackman were the first casting choices. Like, that was a big deal. I think they had a big press release, like, Hackman and Brando are going to be in the movie. And I think it was their way of saying, this is going to be extremely serious. But it is still weird to see the top billing for the movie in the opening credits. It goes Marlon Brando, Gene Hackman, in a Richard Donner film, Superman, and then Christopher Reeve, as if he's just some guy. I think that's funny. And I think he got paid like $3 million for his 10, 15 minutes of screen time and some percentage of the royalties as well. What are, in terms of the moments that work best for you or your favorite scenes or something, where if you were describing this to somebody and you're like, you have to see this movie, this like moment makes the movie, what do you think stood out the most to you as far as like what, as someone who's not necessarily a big Superman fan, was there a particular moment that endeared you to him where you're like, I get it, I get why people like him?
I think the whole of him saving Lois from the helicopter.
Yeah.
I think that was probably probably the first big moment of big action in the movie too.
Yeah.
And it starts what essentially becomes the montage of who yes. Superman is and
yeah.
how he's going to help people. It reminded me of just kind of like escalating levels in a video game. You kind of start with, I guess the helicopter would be more of a tutorial, then you move on to saving, who does he save after
so
that?
He stops the guy climbing
yes,
on the
guy
building.
Climbing the thing. Then there's the shootout. So you're escalating a little. Let me dial it back. He saves a kitty.
Yeah.
And the kid gets slapped by her mom. That was very troubling to me. And then he's like, okay, final boss time. Save this airplane.
Right. That's the big, save the Air Force One. Not just airplane. The airplane.
The one.
But that was,
I think that was, yeah, a big milestone moment in the movie.
I love the sequence where he saves her. I adore it. And I love it's so perfectly like the way they build it up and the chaos of the moment. And then you have him coming out, seeing the phone booth, you get that great laugh moment. And then you have like the big moment where he rips open his shirt.
A little too early, I might add.
Yeah.
Someone could have been watching.
It's true. Someone
could
have seen
him. I suppose.
At that point, no one knew who Superman was, but it's so good. And then I love that he runs through the revolving door to transform all his clothes and everything
disappears.
That.
And then later in the movie, he just changes.
Yes.
They don't explain it.
My thought is he is so fast that we don't even see it.
That
although then of course, like, wait, what happened to his clothes at all? He can't feel like what it should have been. He transforms and then clothes just fly everywhere.
Yeah.
Like that would have been perfect. There are, I don't want to spoil Superman 2 completely, but Superman 2, has a barrage of invented Superman power. There's a whole sequence where they just throw new powers at you without explanation. One of them is the cellophane S, which you may have seen parodied and other things where he tears a cellophane S off and uses it to stop a bad guy in his tracks. That's one of the many powers.
A bat utility belt.
Yes.
Or is this Superman shark repellent?
There are moments in Superman 2, that whole sequence is like, what is happening?
Well, and that's something to think about too. I think that's a common criticism of Superman as a character is that he's just... He's just too powerful.
Yeah.
He's the kid that just is like, well, I have this power now, and I have this power now. But I thought this movie didn't do that. We didn't even see heat vision in this movie.
We didn't, and I forget about that. Well, you do see it in Superman 2, but I forget that you never actually see him use it in this movie.
It's a pretty iconic Superman power, I think. And, yeah, we get the X-ray vision. But yeah, no heat vision.
Yeah, so he gets like you get to see all his powers. You get to see him use all this stuff. Superman 2, yeah, it becomes a problem. The one thing, and this is what I think a lot of people criticize specifically about Superman, to bring it back to that point, is the ending where he turns the world back.
And I would also criticize that. I was going to point that out as probably my biggest negative of this movie. I had a lot of goodwill for this movie that was just building and building throughout, and then that very Deus Ex Machina ending took all the stakes out of the situation and really left a sour taste in my mouth.
Yeah, it's part of the problem, I think, with... I love the effect I love, in terms of the emotional journey for him, I love what it represents, that this godlike being basically violates the laws of humanity because he wants to save the woman he loves. I'm like, okay, if I can bring it down to a personal level,
mm-hmm.
I love what it's saying about him and what it's saying about his relationship with Lois. And I just love the, like, going back in time and how cool it looks. But as you're saying, if you can do that, where are the stakes?
It, looking at the grand scheme of things, is why you're literally never in danger, yes. unless there's a kryptonite necklace around you, I suppose.
Right.
Because you could just turn back time. But I see the parallels. Obviously, the movie made the parallels pretty mm-hmm. clear between Papa Kent. What's Pa Kent?
Yeah, Jonathan Kent.
John
yeah.
and Martha. That's it. I always right. forget.
Martha.
And then Lois Lane. But I think it could have been, I was still thinking about Greek tragedy in this, mm-hmm. and he's doing something he was explicitly told not to do, interfering with human history, and he's doing it for a selfish reason.
Yeah.
I think there's value in that as a device in the plot if he then pays for yes. that.
There's
if,
no consequence.
But there's
to
no.
It.
Yeah. He just like, nope, I say. And then literally the next scene, we don't even see it. He just grabs Luther, and now Luther's in jail.
Yeah, everything's fine. Exactly. Yeah. I think a lot of, what I was talking about with the third act kind of feeling a little jumbled is specifically that. And a lot of it is because Superman 1 and 2 were shot back to back when the production was kind of going south and they were afraid they weren't going to finish. They were already over budget. They weren't going to finish. They basically were like, as a means of saving themselves, the producers were like, let's just release the first one. We're not going to finish the second one. Donner had shot about 75% of Superman 2, but they were like, we need to stop. Let's just release it now. They apparently were saving the turn back time scene for something at the end of Superman 2 instead. Doesn't justify it in any way, but they were like, we're going to save this for that movie. But the problem was now they were like, oh, we need to finish with like a big, strong ending. Let's just put that amazing effect at the end of the first movie. We'll wrap it all up and it'll be great. But it feels very like, wait, did the earthquake happen or did it not happen? Did he stop that? Jimmy's still acting like Superman found him and dropped him off. Why isn't Lois falling into a hole? Like what? And then all of a sudden, like you said, we are cutting straight to Lex Luthor is in jail. Yeah, we got him.
It doesn't feel earned.
Yeah. It is very rushed. And I think a lot of it has to do with that, with the production woes of that. But I really love the earthquake stuff. I love him flying around and saving mm-hmm. everybody. And I think that's all.
I was thinking the whole time that it seems like a direct parallel to Krypton in the beginning.
Yeah.
Because Jor-El couldn't save Krypton from what amounted to a lot of earthquakes. There was a lot more, obviously, because we saw the planet explode. But what we saw on screen was a lot of earthquakes. And I think there's a similar thing. Now Superman can come in and do what Jor-El could not do on a different planet.
I never actually, in all my zillions and zillions of viewings of this movie, I've never thought about that.
I kept wondering, why are they showing all these people running from right. their homes in this town that's about to be destroyed, and it seemed similar to me.
Yeah,
so I thought
I think that's a very good interpretation. I think it's actually very cool because it connects the beginning.
It
and
also
the end of it
reminded
well.
Me of a way, because Superman's so powerful, it can be hard to challenge him.
Yeah.
And I think it's a lot of writers over the years have struggled to make good conflicts for a man who has everything.
Who can turn back time.
but one way to do it, and I think this movie showed that, is just to give him a gauntlet to go through. Maybe you can save this person, but can you save them while this other person across the country is also in danger? And you need about 9 different situations going on for Superman to be challenged.
Right, and it's why the turning time back at the end feels so like much
right,
of a
cop-out.
Because
he failed. Because
the movie,
in his own way.
Yeah, the movie, he's had to deal with consequences of things. He's succeeded in most of what he's done, and then when he finally has to learn a horrible lesson, he's like, no.
Lessons mean nothing.
So it's like, the in terms of an arc or consistent character storyline or through line, it's kind of like, like I said, I don't debate anybody who's like that throws the movie off for me. I'm kind of like, the way I learned to appreciate it was just to examine it from strictly the relationship point of view of he loves Lois so much that he's going to do something completely forbidden. It is forbidden for you to interfere. Mm-hmm. You know, he's going to do forbidden, something like forbidden. For true love, he does it. But I agree. And it's partly why I think a lot of, in this day and age, this movie is so iconic and it's so up on a pedestal. People feel like they can only recreate this movie, which is what Bryan Singer did with Superman Returns, which I like as a Superman, the movie fan, but I think has significant flaws. Mm. Have you seen Superman Returns?
Of course I haven't. But this is that the one that's sort of, it's supposed to be in the same universe as this, well, but it ignores.
Yeah,
it's other
Brandon Routh and Kate Bosworth and Kevin Spacey as Luthor. Yeah. And it's a really great homage to Donner's Superman. Mm. And it basically kind of, it is in the same universe. It uses the John Williams theme. It's wonderful. There are a lot of parallels, but it's also almost beat for beat the same movie, to the point where there's an earthquake at the climax of the movie that Superman has to stop. Like, it's literally the same
movie.
And
isn't Lois married to Lex in that movie?
No, she's married to James Marsden, who's just Perry's nephew or son or something.
Got a Mary Jane, John Jameson from Spider-Man 2.
Yes. No, exactly. Very right. Similar to that. But the problem is, so you can either remake Superman the movie, which is fine, but Superman... This movie works for its time period in the same way a Roger Moore Bond works for its time period. But you can't release a Roger Moore movie today. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work, especially not in the climate that Daniel Craig has created. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the solution is not Man of Steel. It's not go in the completely opposite direction, make it dark, gritty, make him angry. That's not why I get that on the surface level, you're like, oh, he needs to be more like Batman because people love Batman. But what makes Superman special is he's Superman. So mm-hmm. find a different way to keep the character the same, keep him like the heartfelt, sincere, fun, but give him obstacles just like Captain America, Winter Soldier. Captain America is the perfect, he's Marvel's Superman, but it's the perfect, to me, I always reference that. I'm like, Winter Soldier is the perfect example of taking a character who's like a do-gooder Boy Scout type and putting him in a situation where he has to compromise some of his values. He has to ask some hard questions and it's a little bit darker, but you're not compromising the character. Mm-hmm. I think we're still missing that. I feel like we need the modern day, like Casino Royale version of Superman. And that's not, again, not to say it needs to be gritty and dark. We need something that understands the character, but is able to update it in a way that works for this day and age. The problem is, this movie is so good, people I think feel challenged by it. But a lot of the Superman stuff we see in this movie is the same stuff that people complain about, like he's too powerful, he's too perfect, he can turn back time and all that stuff. It was all taken from, a lot of it was taken from the comics, but a lot of it is because of this movie. I think people are so attached to this movie that they can't separate themselves and say, well, maybe we just make him a little less invincible, maybe he's a little less strong, maybe he can't turn back time and move planets or whatever.
Maybe we should put some reasonable limits on
his
powers.
Exactly. So, but with this movie, it doesn't matter so much because the innocence of it, the sincerity and the entertaining, like the entertainment value of it to me is so high that I forgive the flaws and the things that are goofy and the things that don't make sense. Cause I'm like, I am having such a good time watching this, and Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder are so delightful that I'm good with it. And another question for you. Favorite line from the movie?
Favorite line from the movie.
Is it, haven't I told you to stop telling lies?
That's up there.
That's one of my favorites.
No, I can't think of, I think probably going back to Lois's line about every politician would be on your list. And if you're...
One of my favorite lines, I was saying this end of the movie. It's not a line, but it's when... Miss Tessmacher says, but Lex, my mother lives in Hackensack. And he looks down at his watch, looks up at her, and without saying a word, just shakes his head and walks away.
I think I would have to do inventory of Lex Luthor lines, Gene Hackman, Lex Luthor lines, because they were all so good.
He's great. I love the interview with Superman and Lois. I think it's so charming and so, they're both so wonderful in that movie, and I love them so much. Again, this is like, how many superhero movies would you say one of the main set pieces is two characters sitting down for an interview and then flying around the city for a romantic tour? It's like, That's what I
was going to say Batman Forever, but the flying around kind of limits.
Bats aren't rodents, Dr. Meridian. See, that's what this movie needed.
It's the car, right? Chicks love the car.
But I have too much love for this movie. It's hard for me to be critical about it. I can, as I think I've already demonstrated, I can point out the flaws of this movie, but the overall effect of the film is so strong and works so well for me that I'm like, I don't care. I can nitpick, but I have so much fun watching it that I still to this day think it's fantastic. And I think watching it on the big screen, it was just even more impressive to see how well it still holds up. Even the effects, which I think are a little dated, still are like, this looks pretty good, all things considered. But that's that. Anything else you have to say about Superman?
No, I think overall there was a lot to like. I think as far as I'm trying to sit back and like, what did I learn from this movie? I think the idea is that Superman he's a leader by example.
Yeah.
And that he's not supposed to solve the world's problems, but supposed to give us an example of how to live so we can solve our own problems.
Right.
And I think up until the ending, this movie was really accomplishing that in a lot of ways. But the ending it did rub me the wrong way, if you can't tell.
Yeah.
So.
No, I gotcha. So how, in terms of how you felt about Superman before versus how you feel about Superman now, do you feel more inclined to watch go forth and watch more of the movies? Are you going to maybe delve into the character a little bit more? How do you feel?
I'm intrigued to see more of the Christopher Reeve movies. I think he was a wonderful Superman and Clark Kent.
Yeah.
And so I'd want to see him do more. I'm, of course, sad that we didn't start with Superman 4, The Quest for Peace. That movie has such a golden reputation.
It does. It truly
so
does.
So maybe I'll just go right there. Maybe I'll just skip 2 and 3.
Straight ahead. You don't
go
need the
straight
others.
To Superman 4.
Yeah. That's what I think. That was the intended viewing experience, I'm sure. So I guess final ratings on a scale of 1 to 5. Do you want to do Otisburgs or super stomach aches?
Otisburg.
Let's do on a scale of 1 to 5 Otisburgs, with 1 being the lowest and 5 being the highest. How many Otisburgs would you give Superman?
I'm going to have to sadly go right in the middle. I'll say 3 Otisburgs.
Nice. I'll give it a 5 because I love this movie so much. Even with its problems, I still think it is lovely. But TC, I'm so thrilled I got to watch this movie with you, and I got to experience your first time with Superman. Well, that sounded dirty, but I meant it to be that way.
Do you have X-ray vision, Sean?
I sure do. Pink.
Whoa. No, thank you for having me. Absolutely. I would not have known this movie was playing in a theater, of course, if you hadn't told me. So I'm glad that I got to see it in that setting, and I owe that to you.
It's a good thing you
know. And I'm glad like to be on your podcast.
Yeah, well, you're welcome anytime. We'll come back and watch Superman 2. It'll be great. Or Superman 4, I'm sorry. We'll just watch Superman 4. But I would also encourage our listeners, if you're listening to this on iTunes or a place where you can rate us, please rate us and give us the happiest 5-star rating you possibly can. And then also you can feel free to, again, follow The Nerd Party on Twitter at Join Nerd Party, on Facebook, The Nerd Party. And you can follow me on Twitter at Yay Sean Dorman. And TC, are you anywhere on social? You want people to talk with you?
I am on social. I'm not very active on social. I'm probably the most active on my Instagram. That's at TC Padgett.
Perfect.
Occasional and funny things.
Send him lots of Otis memes. That's what he needs. That's what the world needs. I think if there's one thing we can take away from Superman, it's that the world needs an Otis extended universe.
That's absolutely true. I want to know if there's a comic book version of Otis that was introduced after this movie.
Or possibly
there's an Otis that they took from the comics. I'm just not aware.
I think if we can get Nuclear Man in the comics, which Bendis has, he has Nuclear Man from Superman 4, I think we can get an Otis appearance as well.
At least an Otis Bird.
Yes, Brian Michael Bendis, I know you're listening. Let's get Otis back in Superman, please.